I'd certainly like to thank Alex and Malbika for giving me the opportunity to speak here. And as things turns out, I think I was a bit ambitious when I wrote the title for this talk, and I probably have to, for someone who writes and speaks as quickly as I do, I probably have to choose between the oscillating part and the magnetic part. And for the most part, I think I'll stick with oscillating, and if I get to say some things about magnetic potentials as well, then so much the better. I'm going to be working with linear evolution estimates for a Schrodinger equation. So a time derivative of a solution U minus a Laplacian plus some linear perturbation that has a scalar part, V of Tx, and also a first order part with some vector field A of Tx dotted with the gradient of U, and have this equal to 0 in Rn, and I'm going to take n to be 3 or greater. If I get lazy, then in my numerology, I might forget that n is a general number and might start acting as though it's 3. And in general, I'll sometimes maybe want to talk about this as just a shorthand. It's a linear first order differential operator that depends on time. And you should make this an initial value problem. We have some initial data f of x, probably in L2. And throughout this talk, although I'd love to tell you some theorems about general time-dependent perturbations of this nature, for the moment that seems to be beyond my reach. So I'm generally going to make an assumption here that whatever the perturbation is, it's going to be periodic in time. And I'll give it time period 2 pi. So, to get started, let's array some of the already quoted facts for what happens if, in fact, this linear first-order perturbation is the trivial one, in which case you can write out a solution simply as being e to the I t Laplacian, acting on the initial data. And you could even write that out explicitly if you needed to, up to some sign errors of 1 over 4 pi I t to the n over 2. And you write it as a convolution integral against the kernel e to the minus I times complex Gaussian. And from this, for example, you can immediately read off an evolution estimate from L1 initial data to L infinity. And this is the traditional route by which you get Ginieber and Velo's proof of the Strickarts estimates or Kiel and Tau's endpoint estimates. I'm going to focus mostly on the Strickarts estimates here. So once again, to write out the numerology, if I have initial data in L2, we've got that e to the minus I t Laplacian f in some spaces, let's see, what have I been calling them? I'm calling them Lp of t, Lq of x. This is controlled by an L2 norm of the initial data. And here, since we're just working in H0, it's 2 over p plus n over q is equal to n over 2, and p and q can range between 2 and infinity, and because I'm working in 3 and higher dimensions, I don't have to add in any other technicalities or restrictions. Now, one other very useful estimate that's going to be behind pretty much everything is to reformulate this via TT star, at least morally via TT star argument, as the Kiel-Tau propagator estimate, that if I make up an operator, I'll call it U plus, acting on a function in n plus 1 dimensions, being an integral of the propagation of a non-homogeneous Schrodinger equation. That this is an operator which maps, for example, L2 with respect to L2n over n plus 2 in space, and maps that to its dual. And so this, for example, is certainly part of the Kiel-Tau paper and endpoint in 1998. So the question is, this is all known for the free evolution of the Schrodinger equation. If I'm working with a non-trivial perturbation, is it still legal to say that the solution operator for this, does this have the same LP of time, LQ of space estimates as the free equation did? And I'm going to address this question, and it seemed like the best way to do this is to talk about more difficult problems, but on the blackboard only solve the simple ones. So for starters, let's make our life easier and try a perturbation which is actually dependent only on the x variable and is trivially periodic in time. And let's also have the vector field be zero. And if we write things out this way, then we'll certainly be in a situation where I can represent the propagator. I'll have a fixed operator minus Laplacian plus V, and I can represent propagation as a spectral multiplier. So U of Tx is just e to the it times minus Laplacian plus V, acting on the initial data. And a lot of things are going to depend on the spectral properties of this operator. For instance, if this happens to have point spectrum, then you know that I'm going to call this equation star to refer back to it. And if we're in the position where minus Laplacian plus V has some eigenfunction, phi, well, then there's a solution that looks like U of Tx is e to the it times whatever its eigenvalue is, 5x. That's going to be a solution to the equation, and it means that star could only be satisfied if p happens to be infinity, q happens to be 2, and that's not the most exciting inequality. So the question is whether that's the only obstruction, and it turns out for a fairly large class of short-range in space perturbations, that really is the only obstruction to getting the Strickart's estimates. So I'll state this as a theorem, and let me, before I forget, you might have noticed I haven't symmetrized the first order part of this perturbation, and I could make some assumption that the divergence of A is zero in order for that to be self-adjoint, but I'm not going to make any such assumption. In fact, I'm also not going to make an assumption that the scalar function V is real-valued. So we're not assuming that this is a self-adjoint Schrodinger operator, and some of the motivation for this is, for example, in some recent work I know of by Krieger and Schlag and some others dealing with stability of solitons for NLS, they're forced to work with the linearization of this problem is not a self-adjoint operator. So we need to be careful about the spectral theory of such things. So in this case, what I can say for scalar potentials is that if I have a potential in Ln over 2 of Rn, and this is an operator of about the same order as the Laplacian, so this seems like a critical space in terms of both the singularities it allows and the short-range decay that that you can have in this. And it's complex-valued, and suppose that each one of the eigenfunctions, so we have some eigenfunctions minus Laplace plus V acting on psi is equal to some lambda psi, and there's also the adjoint problem, minus little policy n plus v bar, which is going to have also some eigenvalues. But suppose each of the solutions, which happens to belong to the space L2n over n minus 2, that's got decay that's not necessarily in L2, but suppose that these are also in the better space 2n over n plus 2, in which case, by interpolation, these are also true L2 eigenfunctions. And I need one more assumption, which is merely a convenience, which is to have that the L2 inner product of the eigenfunctions for these conjugate equations to not vanish. This is just a condition that makes sure that the eigenspace is of depth 1, that it only has simple true eigenfunctions and not some generalized eigenfunctions of order 2 or greater. If we suppose these, then first of all, there's only finitely many of them. And second of all, as long as we keep away from them, the Strickhart's estimates in equation star are true. So for all initial F and L2, which happen to be orthogonal to the span of the vectors psi tilde. And as a few extra notes, that if V happened to be a real valued function, then the only eigenfunctions you would need to worry about would be the ones at lambda equals 0. Those are the only ones that could exist that wouldn't necessarily have such fast decay. And in fact, that's also only a problem in dimensions smaller than 7. So with any luck, this isn't too much to ask for. So now let's go about proving in some detail this easier theorem. And I'll start out by symmetrizing a couple of things. So I'll come up with one function, which is essentially the square root of V, and a second function, which I'll just define so that it's everything. It basically is a signum function. And let's just throw Duhamel's formula at the solution to this equation. And if you use Duhamel's formula then, and a little bit of linear algebra, then first you have the free propagation of the initial data, and then you get a second term, which should be a free propagation of V times the actual solution. But if you do a bit of linear algebra on this, I can write this as identity minus IV U plus VZ inverse. So this is a functional inverse. And then I have VU plus of F. So all of this is just a complicated way of writing out the solution of the perturbed equation. And an observation here is that by Kato smoothing, this is known to belong to L2 with respect to Rn plus 1. And similarly, this is known by the Kiel-Tau estimate that this should map L2 to the Strickhart spaces. And so that leaves us with the question of this inverse operator. First of all, is it bounded on L2? And second of all, one thing you can see is that if the potential happens to be small enough, then it turns out that you can just expand this inverse by a power series, and it will certainly be bounded. And if not, well, maybe you can apply some functional analysis magic to get that it's still a bounded or cooperative argument operator. Although if you do that, then you should be a little bit careful about whether it preserves the supportive functions on positive time, because this is Duhamel's formula for the solution propagating forward, and I'm going to be rather unhappy if my answer involves a non-zero function at negative times. So the interesting cases are the ones where this is not a bounded operator, in which case you just have to make sure that what you're feeding into it happens to be in the directions where it's not at its worst behavior, and see if you can get some balance between the unboundedness of the inverse versus the nature of the input that that it's acting on. And at this point, a lot of our work ends up being much easier if we take a Fourier transform in the time variable. So this operator U plus, which is convolution in time with e to the minus it Laplacian. Well, if it's convolution in time on the Fourier transform side, it should be some sort of pointwise multiplication. And it's going to be pointwise multiplication by I times the inverse of minus Laplacian minus, and I'll call my dual variable tau. And so this is just a resultant in, because I'm going forward in time, and I think if I have my signs correct, then I need this to be continue analytically to the lower half plane. And I'll call this the negative resolvent, that's I times r minus of tau. So, in that case, if I want to look at this operator inverse on the Fourier side, this is just going to be identity plus some multiplication operators and a resolvent of the Laplacian. So the question of whether this is bounded on L2, it's a question as to whether these operators are uniformly bounded with respect to real numbers tau. And if not, then we have to see what happens. So let's say some things about this operator. First of all, it's a continuous family of operators on L2. And in fact, they're compact operators. So by the Fredholm alternative, the only thing that I need to worry about is whether or not it has exact eigenvectors or not. And a second thing is that if I take a limit as tau goes to infinity of the norm of such things, this vanishes to zero, which means that, in fact, for large values of tau, I know that I can find the inverse by a power series. It's certainly going to be uniformly bounded. So I only have to worry about what happens in some compact range of tau. And if I can show that there are only going to be isolated eigenvalues in this range, then there's only going to be finitely many of them, and I can deal with them individually, and it won't take forever. And as far as how you would prove some of these things, this is, since this is a harmonic analysis workshop, I should mention some harmonic analysis here, that one of the ways you can get at this is to represent the resolvent of the Laplacian. Well, it's a singular Fourier multiplier. So at C, all I'm doing is I'm multiplying by 1 over C squared minus tau. If tau is a positive number, then there's also something rather bad happening at the sphere of radius, the square root of tau. And this just is a surface measure, which I'm probably going to get the sign wrong. but don't worry about that too much. And so this is a surface measure on the sphere of radius square root of tau. And if you look at things this way, for example, you get what's known as the limiting absorption principle. That, for example, if I just bookended it with some weights, then I would get decay pretty much exactly at this rate, 1 over the square root of tau. And once you have this, then I guess the fact that it's bounded operators at all using V that aren't weights but are rather in LP classes, that's due to a result by Koenig, Ruiz, and Sog, I think it's 1987. And last but not least, once you have this, then you can just approximate these functions W, approximate them by something that's continuous, compactly supported, use the limiting absorption principle, then take some limits, and the fact that it vanishes at infinity is preserved even if the rate of decay is not preserved. So I guess in that respect, it's something like a Riemann-Lebesgue lemma. And just in case I don't get back to magnetic potentials during this talk, I want to point out that if I had to throw in a first-order perturbation, if there were a gradient here, then the fact this is radius square root of tau would pretty neatly cancel what's in the denominator, and in fact, this limit of the operator norm would not be zero, and it makes you have to worry very much more about what happens when tau is large, that you have to come up with a much better reason that you have uniform control of these operators. And that part, a lot of the work was done jointly with Burak Erdogan and Wilhelm Schlag. If I have time, I'd love to talk about that. We'll see how things go. So at this point, we've got the Fredholm alternative at us, which says that the inverse is going to exist unless there is one of these functions, one of these functions phi at an eigenvalue tau. And actually, for the operator as I've written it out here, the null space of the operator is actually conjugated, so it's W times phi. And here, the space I have to worry about is 2n over n minus 2. And I should also worry about what the image of this function is because I'm trying to take its inverse. So the I plus weight resolvent weight is going to be the orthogonal complement of the kernel of its adjoint, which is VW bar, and the eigenfunction for the adjoint operator. Now, what we'd like to have happen here is we'd like to write the inverse out as a Laurent series so that we'd see some kind of a simple pole emerging here. And if we were dealing with some exponentially weighted spaces, we could do this because the resolvent would continue analytically on both sides of the real axis. We're not giving ourselves quite that much freedom. So what we're going to have to see is that even though this is not differentiable in tau in general, in the directions that are most important to us, it resembles being differentiable enough that we can at least get the minus first order part of the Laurent series expansion correctly. So So let's go to work. We'll try to find the inverse more or less by hand. And here you have to look at things. Let's plug in, for instance, an eigenvalue into this, or the eigenfunction, which is w psi, and let's see what its projection is for different values, nearby values of tau, what its projection is in the forbidden direction, psi tilde. And you eventually work out that this looks like t0 minus tau times the inner product of psi and psi tilde, and then there's a correction of size tau of second order, psi times a resolvent of tau acting on psi tilde. And here, I need for these to be in the better weighted spaces so that this pairing actually makes sense, because this generally takes as its input maybe functions in L2n over n plus 2, and I also have to be able to pair it with a function, so I'm going to need more decay there as well in order to get this expansion to be meaningful. And here, what we've used to get to this point are simply identities like the difference between the resolvent at tau versus at tau 0 is tau minus tau 0 times the product of two resolvents. That's just linear algebra. And then we've used the eigenvalue equations that the resolvent acting on v phi is equal to minus phi, and similarly for phi tilde and with v conjugate. So if you do several calculations of this nature, then eventually you build the inverse of this operator by hand, and you get that the norm difference, or the norm, if I apply the inverse to a general function g, there's essentially the singular part is a rank 1 operator that has to do with this forbidden vector v phi tilde, and so I'll have 1 over this inner product times tau minus tau 0 inverse times the inner product with the forbidden vector, and everything else is basically okay. Now let's remember the vector we're plugging in here. It comes from one of these equations. I guess it really comes from here, that this is the vector we actually need to plug into our unbounded operator. And let's see what happens at that point. So the most dangerous part of this is going to come from this 1 over tau minus tau 0, and it's, so I have 1 over tau minus tau 0 times an inner product of W resolvent acting on F. That's what I'm feeding into the operator. I need to take its inner product with the forbidden vector, and so this is measured in L2 of tau and x. And once again, if you apply the resolvent and the eigenvalue identities to this, then what I get is 1 over tau minus tau 0 times, well, at tau 0, I get to throw everything onto the right side, use an eigenvalue identity, and I'll have the inner product of f with phi tilde. By assumption, we're starting with initial data orthogonal to that, and it goes away. And the next correction term is tau minus tau 0, and we have an inner product of r minus of tau acting on f and paired with phi tilde, and we want this in L2 with respect to tau and x. And this is just a Cotter smoothing estimate. So the evolution of L2 data, ordinarily it's going to be in something like in three dimensions it would be in L6 of x, L2 of time, and so I just need to pair it with something that's in the dual LP space. So this is going to be comparable to f in L2 times phi in spaces like 2n over n plus 2, or you could put it in weighted L2, either one of these, just anything that makes the Cotter smoothing calculations work correctly. So that's how you do things if you're just working with a time-independent scalar potential in this class. And one thing I like about this is that it enables you to handle point spectrum that might be embedded within the continuous spectrum of the operator. It might enable you to handle certain types of eigenvalues that are right at the threshold energy zero. And it doesn't seem to worry too much about where any of this point spectrum happens to be, because the resolvent difference identity is the same regardless of the value of tau zero. So now I'll just talk a bit about how you fix things for time periodic potentials. And first of all, the class that I can work with at the moment is Ln over 2 with respect to time, L infinity with respect to space, L infinity with respect to time. This is a somewhat awkward order, and I guess orders like this came up in Keith Rogers' talk earlier today. And I'd be happier if I could reverse these and have a slightly weaker condition. But for the moment, there are various times that I need to do Fourier transforms in the time variable. So I need to make sure that I have it placed on the inside of the calculation. So that's what I can work with, and it enforces some sort of a localization of the potential over all times, that it can't run out and come back. So we can do this, and the factorization that we use is pretty much the same, that I'll just take an L infinity norm. So V of dot comma x, measure that in L infinity, take that as the square root, and then I'll have V of tx is equal to w squared times z. So this is periodic. It's in L infinity. It's bounded by 1. And one thing I'll note is that if I take the Fourier transform of this with respect to time, since it's periodic, it's going to be supported in the planes where tau is strictly an integer. So therefore, and the whole setup of this argument was to create some sort of an invariant space in the Fourier side of things where I could look for a compact perturbation of the identity and work Fredholm theory. So in this case, the operator, and I'll put this in quotation marks, of identity plus resolvent, that's pointwise in tau, but of course convolution with z hat is not pointwise in tau anymore, but at least you have an invariant space of L2 and Rn, and it moves the frequency around by integers. So I can represent that here. So these are more or less cosets of tau plus integers. So these are the spaces of quasi-periodic functions. So g of t plus 2 pi x is equal to e to the 2 pi I tau times g of t x. And I need to worry about whether I have solutions to the equation that are quasi-periodic and belong to bad classes. And because of all of this, when I want to use Poincaré's theorem, It's going to be over the torus and the tau variable, and it's going to be something of a discrete Fourier transform in the time variable, just sampling at regular time intervals of 2 pi. And here's what we can do along those lines. In this class, if we suppose that each one of the quasi-periodic solutions, which I'll creatively call capital phi again, and the dangerous space for them to be in would be something like L2n over n minus 2 with respect to space, and L2 with respect to the time torus. And this does not have fast enough decay to be in L2, that if we suppose that it also belongs to L2, at this point, you can use local regularity to get that they're actually going to be continuous functions with data in L2. And so that's not anything particularly clever. So then phi also is in continuous of 0 to pi with data in L2, which means that I can actually talk about the initial value at t equals 0. And I'll call that lower phi, lowercase phi. And now the claim is that if each one of these decays about one power faster than being in L2, then I can project away from them and recover the Strickhart's estimates for every other type of initial data. And some of the spaces that make this work, there's one power better than L2 with a polynomial weight. You can also get this by having one weak derivative in L2n over n plus 2. And there are other spaces that I don't want to come up with the specifics because what I have, I'm not convinced that it's a perfectly sharp result. And we'll see what it takes. That if this is the case, first of all, again, there are going to be finitely many because they can only exist in some compact regime of the parameter, and there's going to be some enforced separation or isolation of each of the eigenvalues. There are finitely many, and our Strickhart's estimate star holds for all initial data, which is perpendicular to the span of the vectors phi tilde. So as long as you don't look like the adjoint solution, then you get very good behavior. And the argument is really not so different. You have to once again build the inverse by hand to make sure that it really only has something that resembles a simple pole at each one of the eigenvalues. And then you plug in the function based on the initial data into this and try to make sure that what you put into this unbounded operator stays away from the part where it's most unbounded. And at the end of the day, it reduces to something that I'll call a discrete in time Kato smoothing estimate. There's probably a more official name, I just don't happen to know it. And I need to estimate a sum over integers of an inner product e to the minus 2 pi I k times Laplacian acting on f up against this eigenvalue-derived vector phi tilde. And so I need that to be comparable to the L2 norm of F times some norm squared of phi. And here the question is, what space will make this sort of inequality work? Now, since I need this to be finite when k equals 0, it should be clear that this space is going to have to be a subspace of L2, but we have to figure out what else it requires. And we'll just play around with Poincaré's theorem a bit more, and we have a sum of, over k of, and here I'm going to first apply Poincaré's Parseval's identity to the L2 inner product and integrate in polar coordinates. So I have e to the minus 2 pi I k times a radial variable. And now I have an inner product of f hat restricted to the sphere of radius square root of r, inner product with the restriction of phi tilde hat to the same sphere. And then there's some weight. And then I need to square this. But what I really have here now, if I apply Poincaré's theorem in K, then I've got an L2 norm of some Fourier series of a function in the R variable. So that's going to be equal to a periodization where I take this restricted inner product, so minus 1, phi tilde hat, also restricted to the square root of r. And then there's the weight. And here I left out this should be r plus m to make a periodization. And similarly, r plus m to the n over 2 minus 1. And at the end of the day, I need this to be a square integrable function as r ranges between 0 and 1. So it simply suffices to put phi tilde into a space where I know that this kind of a function of R is going to be bounded, which means that I need to know something about the spherical restrictions of phi, of the Fourier transform of phi tilde. And I just want to mention here that one way you could do this, this certainly has some kind of a little L2 of, this just is going to be in some sort of little L2 of big L2 estimate from here. So I want to put phi tilde in a space, perhaps where it's going to be in little L2 of L infinity with respect to R, so that then I have something that's in L1 of L2, and I can do the periodization, and I know I'm going to still get a square integrable function at the end of things, regardless of what L2 function F I happen to plug into it. And this is how I came up, how we came up with things like the weighted L2 space, or in this case, things like the Stricart space. You get restrictions, but you have to be careful about the scaling. So maybe you need some additional weight in order to make sure that it decays fast enough with large R. Or you have to play around with this quite a bit and play around with the continuity properties of the restrictions, because it's easy to get this in, for instance, L infinity of L infinity or L2 of L2. And if you have some sort of continuity in the restrictions, that's how you can get locally from L2, get from there up to L infinity and make all of the estimates work. I see that I'm out of time, so thank you. Yes.
What's the theorem about the
Well, in the magnetic potentials, I'm forced to work in something that looks like a weighted L2 space. I believe that what I need is maybe that, so V of X or V of A, maybe they're smaller than X to the minus 2 minus epsilon. For the magnetic part, I might be able to get away with one better power. And I